You're where it's at, folks. AllThingsTrek.com. I'm Bob.
And I'm Oren. See, that intro sounded better. It sounded more natural.
It did. Like it.
We're making that the new standard. Everyone, remember where you were when you listened
to this standard,
episode.
It's a standard, but is it gold or silver?
You know, I don't... As I understand it, the only country to ever really adopt a silver standard was China, and I don't think that worked out very well for them.
I don't know. I think they're kicking ass now.
Right, but they're not on the silver standard anymore.
Oh, they're not?
No, this was a while back.
Okay.
And, like, back when everyone else had the gold standard, China had a silver standard, and they abandoned it around the same time.
Hmm.
But I'm not really sure how that got started. But anyway, we're here today to talk about Star Trek super weapons. But before we get into that, I'm excited to say that the Star Trek RPG that I've been talking about for the last couple of weeks has finally gotten off the ground.
Woo!
Yeah, the crew of the USS Compass
is
now manning Nightingale Station above Cestus 3, I believe, is the planet in question.
It is so rad.
We had a bit of an experience putting the characters together. Bob, why don't you share your insights as a player? That's a noise. That's not really insights so much as a groaning noise that you're making.
I don't think the book's laid out very well, for one.
No, it is not.
The way it is. At least the DS9 one wasn't. The TNG one I didn't really have a problem with, of the books we're using.
I actually think the DS9 book is a little better.
Really?
Well, because, the TNG one, one of my favorites is that, like, it'll have, like in the overlays where it tells you what skills you get from your profession... it has things like certain blocks of skills are arrayed in different color blocks, because it's supposed to look like a Star Trek control panel, but the different color blocks don't correspond to anything.
Mm-hmm. And then some of them are for show.
Yeah, and then some of them are in italics for no reason, and it's like half my players wrote down the wrong skills because they thought they weren't supposed to use the ones that are in italics, and it was all this copying. Anyway, we're going to do it again today.
We're making
our secondary characters. But despite that, we had a lot of fun, and the actual mechanics of the game were pretty solid.
Yeah, I liked how it all worked out and such.
Yeah, and I'm pretty happy with the way with
it's
our
just
crew.
The D6 system is all it is. Just roll D6s at it.
It's D6, and it's got a pretty gentle curve, because it's like, and it doesn't involve a lot of dice munchkining or skill munchkining. There's just, you know, if you want to be better at something, you raise that skill. You don't have to, like, combine a million things.
Yep. I was a little daunted by how many skills we were all getting at first, especially after you went through the character creation process of, like, early childhood, cadet life, tours of duty, all that stuff. It was just like, oh my gosh, all these skills, what am I going to do with them? But now after actually cutting, like, my teeth on this system, because I played a different system years back that was, like, far fewer skills and whatnot.
Yeah.
It was still a TNG Next Generation setting and whatnot, but far fewer skills. But now that I've had a chance to play it and whatnot, I can see why we have so many skills and makes us pretty well-rounded characters, I think.
Yeah.
Well, at least my chief engineer is.
The characters are all pretty well-rounded. I like how it encourages diverse skills instead of just, like, super specializing in a couple of them. I'm pretty happy with the way it's turning out, and I'm excited to continue. Right now, they are engaged in a race with a Klingon bird of prey to see who can rescue a Tholian freighter the fastest.
That's right.
Which is pretty spectacular, in my opinion.
It's pretty rad so far. I can't wait for more today.
All right. So anyway, we're talking about Star Trek super weapons. Now, before we get into Star Trek super weapons, we have to talk about what actually is a super weapon.
Yes.
All right. And at its core, super weapons are all parallels for the atomic bomb. Just straight up. The atomic bomb changed the face of warfare forever. It basically, you know, people kept saying that people keep inventing new weapons and claiming that these weapons will bring peace. Well, congratulations, the atomic bomb to an extent actually did.
My goodness, it did.
Like, not for realsies. It's not like there haven't been wars since the atomic bomb was invented. But the atomic bomb has succeeded in being a weapon that was so powerful that we could not conceivably use it in a war and still expect to have a civilization left to enjoy the proceeds of war.
It was a war-ending device at the time, is what it was, when it was used back in 1945 against Japan.
Right, I mean, we dropped two of them, and that ended the war, and we realized that we could never have a war where both sides were lobbing nukes at each other.
Yep.
It just could not be done. Because if we did...
Hence the Cold War!
Yeah, Cold War. That led into... So that's... Basically, that's what a... Super weapons are all parallels for the atomic bomb. To an extent. Like, obviously, we've gotten farther away from that. And in fiction, super weapons have to fulfill a certain number of requirements in order to be good super weapons. And as a control, just something for us to hold everything against, I will hold out the Death Star as a very good example of a super weapon from a different sci-fi franchise entirely. Oh, right. And the other thing that is very important for super weapons to note is that the good guys never use super weapons, which is ironic because, you know, as we just talked about, super weapons are all parallels for the atomic bomb, and that was us. So I don't really know. I'm not really sure how that happened exactly. But that's, so, you know, so we have the Death Star. And the Death Star is pretty much unstoppable. It's got, and it can do a thing that no other weapon can do. It can blow up a planet. Even though, when you get into the logic of it, it's kind of, like, in the extended universe, they sort of established that the Imperial Starfleet could easily wipe out all life on a planet, so actually blowing it up is a little overkill.
Now, I'm not, like, a huge Star Wars fan, so I'm not really into how much, you know, like, the power curves and all this crazy stuff is for, like, their starships and such. So when they say that, like, the entire Starfleet could blow up a planet, is they all take one shot and blow it up, like the Death Star does, or do they have to chip away at it?
Well, they don't actually blow up a planet, but they bombard the surface and, just, like, eliminate...
make it unlivable.
Yeah, make it unlivable. Which effectively is... which has the same effect, really. I feel like if your goal is to instill fear in nearby systems, if you tell them, hey, we bombarded your neighbor until his planet was unlivable, and then no one is... there's everyone on the planet is dead, it would have roughly the same effect as we blew up his planet. You know, I feel like most people would be just as scared.
I'm sure it'd be the same in, like, casual conversation anyway, when people were talking about it in the cantinas and such.
Right.
You know, they blew up that planet.
But
oh,
not,
my goodness.
Not talking about the extended universe, just from the movies where it was invented, the Death Star could do a thing that nothing else could do.
Right.
And that was what... And then, to further that, it had one flaw that could be exploited by the hero. And you might think that that flaw was the reactor shaft, but you'd be wrong. The flaw of the Death Star is actually the villain's arrogance. And that little trench, that little exhaust port, is basically a parallel for that arrogance. Because if you notice, the reason why they don't just annihilate all the rebels is that Tarkin is just convinced he's going to win. And the same reason why he doesn't evacuate, and why, like, Vader himself has to personally launch the TIE fighters, and why the whole Death Star is designed around a large scale assault because the Empire is convinced that small, you know, one-man hero ships couldn't possibly stand a threat to them. And so, you know, again, it's all about the villain's arrogance, and so it's a dramatic flaw in addition to being a real flaw.
It's pretty deep. I never thought about it that way.
The Death Star is deep, okay? The original Star Wars movies were actually really deep. And so that's, now we've got our control. So let's look at what Star Trek has in the way of super weapons. And because I like to rage, first we're going to start off, we're going to talk about the Scimitar from Nemesis, which takes all of the lessons that we've learned from the Death Star and throws them right out the window. Because we're done with that. We don't have time for effective super weapons these days.
Nope.
All right, so I just talked for like 10 minutes straight. Bob, why don't you tell me what you think of the Scimitar?
I thought the Scimitar was really big and gaudy.
Yeah, I would agree.
Giant. As Picard called it, a predator, right? Mm-hmm. What were the stats that Worf lists off? Like 52 different disruptor banks, 20-some torpedo launchers on the bloody thing.
Yeah.
And it could cloak, right? Which, mm-hmm. I mean, that's kind of standard for Romulan ships, which is actually, this is a Reman ship is what this was. Because Shin Zong built it at his secret base, which who knows where that is.
Apparently, it's a secret mining base full of miners.
But what made the Scimitar different is that it had a thing called a Thaleron weapon.
Right.
Which we saw... one example of that, which was in the movie Nemesis still, when T'Lora kills the Senate.
Right.
She's got that crazy disc-looking thing. She sets that out, and, you know, whoosh! It all sets down, and, like, everyone turns to stone or ash or whatever it is. It kills all the cells in their body. Everything organic was destroyed.
Yeah.
Is what happened with it.
Although, don't the Romulan Senator's clothes also turn to stone? Like, I remember that and being a little
weird. Yes, they do, in fact.
Being a little confused by what was up with that. I think it would have been way funnier if there had been a statue wearing robes.
Well, maybe they just have organic material in their robes. You don't know.
I guess. Romulus has gone green.
Yeah, that's right. Now, the Scimitar itself is a pretty impressive ship, mind you. But it wouldn't, I don't think, be the super weapon that we decided it would be without the Thaleron weapon on it.
No,
the Thaleron weapon, decidedly, as we said, destroys all organic life when it's shot at something or radiates an area.
Yeah, the Thaleron weapon is the actual super weapon part of the Scimitar.
Right, exactly. So, I mean, that being said, Thaleron weapon is just the Thaleron weapon.
Yeah. So, and the reason why the Scimitar fails as a super weapon, you know, is that the Thaleron weapon is supposed to be to the Scimitar as a super laser is to the Death Star. But it doesn't work for a couple of reasons. The first of which is that it's attached to Shin Zong rather than Darth Vader and Grand Moff Tarkin. And we all know that Shinzon is, like, one of the worst villains Star Trek has ever had. But beyond that, just getting into the...
Who can best Picard? Maybe if we cloned Picard.
Also, the clone's going to be bald, and the picture of Picard from his young days is also going to be bald.
Also bald. Which he wasn't bald in Tapestry, though.
No, we know he... Well, I mean, we already know he wasn't bald back then.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, even if we didn't, it's kind of weird to assume that he would have been bald in his 20s. I mean, I know a friend of mine who went bald really early, but even he wasn't bald until, like, his late 20s.
Mm-hmm.
And, like... That was only because he started shaving. So, like, I don't know. That part of it is really weird.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, so we have the Thaleron weapon, and the first instance we see of it used is to kill the Romulan Senate.
Right.
And right away, it fails in that it is actually far less effective than a conventional bomb. If they just put a bomb down, the Senate would have died much faster, and they wouldn't have had nearly as much time to react to it. Because you notice, you know, it opens up and starts glowing, and I have to wonder, what would have happened if one of the Romulans had just shot it? It'd been like, hey,
and just shot cool.
It, just got out there, like, whipped out their disruptor, and, you know, just vaporized it on the table.
Mm-hmm.
Or at the very least, if they had run or something. And it has this, it's extremely obvious and very slow in its delivery.
Yes, it is.
Whereas a bomb can be put in a very innocuous object, like a briefcase, and by the time you realize that
strange disc pink pendant things.
Yeah, or that. And by the time you realize that a bomb is going off, it's usually a little late to do anything about it.
Right.
So right away, there's that problem. Then the scimitar itself has, like, all kinds of logical issues where it's like, how did the Riemanns even build the scimitar? I mean, where...
At their secret base.
Where did they build it? I mean, they're miners and shock troopers, neither of which lends itself to ship design.
But secret base
or secret base.
Secret base.
And then the other problem with the scimitar, its biggest problem is, or I guess its second biggest problem, is that, again, the Thaleron weapon, it wipes out all life on Earth, but we can already do that. We have torpedoes that are like 40 megaton warheads.
It's true, we do.
You know, like, wiping out all life on a planet isn't that hard. Once you get past the planet's defenses, and the Thaleron weapon doesn't help you get past those.
Mm-hmm.
It's because, at least, as I understand it, it won't work against a ship that has its shields up. The only reason it's working...
Sisko even jury-rigged a better weapon than this.
Oh, really?
Yeah, remember for the uniform?
Oh, right, yeah. He just poisoned a Maquis.
Worf, I want these torpedoes full of virus.
Worf, just go cough in those torpedoes, and we'll spread it all over.
I mean, he launched those torpedoes, and they started working, like, instantly.
Right.
Probably, right.
And what's even better is that those weapons were very specifically tailored to be slow kill, because Sisko didn't actually want to wipe out all the people on the planet. He wanted to
force them. He could have made them faster if he wanted to.
He wanted to force them to leave, and so they were very specific weapons, and Sisko made them in, like, you know, half an hour.
Yeah, I know, right?
So, but anyway, then the other problem that the scimitar has is that the Enterprise can fight it. Just straight up. Like, the Enterprise and two Romulan warbirds are engaged in combat with it, and it's... There's nothing special or dramatic going on. It's
just a fight. Sort of.
Hmm?
Now, for the first kind of, I don't know, like 3 or 4 minutes of the fight, the Enterprise is totally getting its ass kicked in that scene, right?
Yeah, yeah.
The only reason they're able to find it is because Troy was like, all right, where's the mind rapist?
Oh, right.
Right? Remember, they went over to Worf's console and was like, all right, shoot torpedoes here, Worf. And then
I did forget about that part.
Yeah, so, I mean, it was working for Shinzon and his cloaked Riemann warbird that had shields up while it was cloaked and firing while it was cloaked.
Right, I liked how they treated that like it was no big deal. It was just a thing that they could do now.
Yeah, his cloak is perfect.
Apparently the Riemanns can also do that.
Yeah.
Well,
if you shove a large enough energy, like, reactor in there, I'm sure you could just do whatever you wanted to with the ship, so...
I'm sure,
the Scimitar kind of subscribed to the Defiant logic, where the ship was too powerful for, like, its size or whatnot, could tear itself apart.
I always assumed that the reason you weren't allowed to fire while cloaked, or have shields up while cloaked, was not so much a power consumption issue, but because if you put on your shields, there's no way the cloak could possibly hide that. And the same thing with weapons fire. If you fire a weapon out of your ship, you've pretty much given away your position. That was always the way.
Well, the weapon thing I can understand. I don't know about the shield so much. I mean, the only thing I've ever heard about the cloak is that we can be cloaked, but because it consumes so much energy, we can't have shields up.
I guess that also would work. But, I mean, they actually... Like, we see that the Enterprise and two Romulan warbirds are able to battle the Scimitar to a draw. And granted, they do have a special telepath who is helping them find it. But we also know that Starfleet, especially with a large fleet of ships, can locate cloaked ships. They've done that before.
With the Tachyon Grid.
Yeah, with the Tachyon Grid. And we know that there's a Starfleet Starfleet fleet, sorry, Starfleet Armada.
Starfleet Task Force.
Yeah, there's a Starfleet Task Force waiting on the other side of the nebula, and for some reason not going into the nebula to help the Enterprise. Anyway, but even if the Enterprise had lost that fight, the Scimitar would have run straight into this Armada, and the Armada would have deployed their tachyon emitters, seen the Scimitar, and blown it to hell.
Mm-hmm.
And there's just no possible way Shinzon's plan could have succeeded. And the ship is not unstoppable. And aside from the mind telepath thing, there is no dramatic flaw to exploit. And that flaw is only shoehorned in there at the last minute to give Troi something to do anyway.
Right.
So it's not, you know, there's no triumph of character, which is what you see in the Death Star trench, is when Luke triumphs by the strength of his character as opposed to because of the strength of his technology and his tools.
Right.
And so that's the Scimitar. And really, I guess at this point, harping on Nemesis is sort of old news.
Because we've done it so often.
Yeah. But the Scimitar, I think we really need to start off with the worst and work our way up.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, when you look at the Scimitar, the other important thing to realize is what the writers were trying to do. Nemesis is sort of the Wrath of Khan, but, like, made by people who didn't really know what they were doing. And they remembered that in Wrath of Khan...
Well, they tried really hard. I felt the disconnect was that Picard didn't actually do anything directly to Shinzon.
No.
At all, like Kirk did to Khan, right? Kirk was like, no, you tried to take over my starship, you get to live on this desert planet now.
Exactly.
With all this stuff, whereas... Here it is, just like, I'm a clone of you. That sucks.
Also, I forget the name of the actor who played Shinzon. But
Tom Hardy.
Tom Hardy and Patrick Stewart have no chemistry. Or at least they didn't in that movie. And that, I could easily see that being a direction issue.
Well, that was one of Tom Hardy's first movies, I think.
Could make sense. Whereas...
Because the next thing I saw him in was Black Hawk Down. Mm-hmm. Which he did fantastic in. And he's had quite a few good roles since then as well.
I believe it. But, like, you know, Kirk and... William Shatner and Ricardo Montalban have great chemistry.
Yeah, they do.
And so, you know, that's where
that
whole
thing... And
they
didn't even meet on the same set at any particular point, either.
Well, not... Yeah, they didn't. They were never actually on stage together at the same time, which is something...
Maybe off-screen, maybe.
Yeah, I'm sure that they met and, like, you know, talked about the role.
Yeah.
Or, like, they could go super method and being like, no, you guys can't ever meet face-to-face. Mm-hmm. This is super method acting. But that's, you know, because Khan had the Genesis device, they felt that Shinzon needed to have a super weapon, too.
Right.
Of some kind. And we're going to talk about the Genesis... Phaleron
generator.
Yeah, we'll talk about the Genesis device a little later, because the Genesis device is awesome.
Yes, it is.
But they... Because they just... They forgot that the core of a superweapon isn't how pretty and scary it looks. Because, you know, they tried to have that whole really ominous thing where all the Scimitar's wings open out for deploying the weapon. And I was like, I don't really know why that's necessary.
It takes a long time to do.
Yeah.
I wonder if you could do it cloaked.
Maybe. You can do everything else while cloaked. You probably have a disco jam.
Because if not, think about it. Like, if it can't do it cloaked, it would roll up on Earth, right? Because the target was Earth after they dealt with the Enterprise, you got Picard's blood or whatever Shinzon wanted to do. Roll up on Earth, and then you have to wait while these wings open, and then the Phaleron generator warms up, right?
It's like, all right, guys, just hold on.
Starbase One's there. It's like, Starfleet Command, we got this ship out here doing a thing.
We're not really sure what exactly it's going to do, but it was clearly designed by someone who wants it to look mean.
It's got a bunch of disruptors on it.
It's got, like, lots of pointy things, and it's kind of stealing the design elements from the Bird of Prey.
It's got a Phaleron signature, energy signature on it.
Yeah. But, like, so, I mean, and basically the writers in that movie were, like, convinced that because the Scimitar looked really impressive, that it was going to
be... Well, it did, though.
Yeah,
it did. It was a very impressive-looking ship.
But it was going to be, like, dramatically impressive, and what they forgot about is that in science fiction, the technology is all there to serve as a conduit for the characters, and
right,
not
exactly.
to hold on its own. And speaking of that, I want to move into the next point on our list, is the Zindi superweapon.
Oh, man. You mean Death Star Mini?
And I never thought I would say this about anything from Enterprise, is actually an improvement over the Scimitar, even though technically Scimitar was later. And yes, as Bob points out, the Zindi superweapon does look a lot like the Death Star.
Form and function.
Yeah, in form and function. It's a sphere that fires a giant laser that destroys a planet.
Yeah!
So, you know, you could say it's just the Death Star again. But at least, the thing about the Zindi weapon, it had something going for it that the Scimitar didn't have, which was that it was in a television show, so they spent an entire season building up to it.
Right.
And obviously this was Enterprise we're talking about, so this was not master-crafted television by any means. But it was dramatically built up to, and there was a lot of expectations placed on the super weapon, and they did establish, they established a pretty good motivation right off the gate by having the mini super weapon kill like a million people on Earth, including Trip's sister.
Mm-hmm.
Even though that raised all kinds of questions of why the weapon was allowed to approach Earth in the first place, whatever, that we can...
Well, it came out of that subspace conduit thingamajig, right, first?
Yeah, it did.
Is what it was. So, I mean, no one really knew it was coming, because, you know,
well, but
we
like,
don't really have Starfleet yet at that
but,
point.
Well, they have some ships. Like, we saw that they had some ships.
They do, it's true, but I don't think any of them were close enough to react at that point. Or they were in dry dock or something,
I guess.
It was. I mean, how many ships do we actually see in Enterprise, or how many are reported to be hanging around?
The most we ever saw was three.
We saw three
ships that were not Enterprise.
Right, so going by Star Trek logic, we probably have a fleet of probably, what, 15 ships?
Yeah.
At that point, so we're talking smaller craft, because the Enterprise was, like, the shit when we were watching Enterprise and such, and then there was the second one, the Columbia, which was going to be rolling out at some point
sometime in the fourth season.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, we have these really... We have ships floating around, but none of them are really close enough to tackle a little mini Death Star rolling out of a subspace conduit that immediately fires a laser... And then ejects itself and goes somewhere else and blows up in the atmosphere or something.
Yeah. See, the thing about it is that when we actually, at the very end of the Zindi arc, when we see the main weapon, like, appear over Earth, it's not that close. Like, you know, it appears, and then it has to go a little ways. It's not, like, immediately popping out of hyperspace and then, you know, blowing the Earth up. It has to travel. It has a little bit of travel time. And I would, I guess maybe as a matter of, maybe because the original weapon was so small, it didn't really register on sensors, I don't know.
Maybe, but I mean, if you look at, like, a parallel today, for instance, of, what's a good one? Let's talk about, like, UFO sightings, for instance.
Yeah.
We have, like, there was a sighting back in 2002 or something like that over Washington, D.C.
Right.
And they decided to scramble, like, F-16 fighters. Now, by the time the fighters, the actual pilots got to their craft and were in the air, it was probably like 10 minutes out before they're actually in, like, off the runway in the air. Then they had to go to wherever it was the problem was still.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So you're still looking at 15, 20 minutes before they can be able to get anywhere.
Right.
So, I mean, if you take that kind of stuff into consideration, like, if you have ships that are in orbit around Earth, for instance, or a dock somewhere, that's a whole lot longer to get a ship out of a dock, right?
I suppose that's true.
You know, also to get reports in from a ship's orbiting Earth, you know, they have to, one, the ship's got its own sensors to see, like, oh my gosh, what is that? Let's analyze this thing first. And then if you're in dry dock, it's like, oh man, there's this thing, get everyone ready to launch. It's going to take forever to get over there.
Yeah, okay. All right, that's fair. All right, I can accept that. And then back to the original Zindi weapon, they also did a thing where they tried to, like, make it, like, they tried to make it more dramatically interesting by having the quest to defeat the Zindi weapon is actually less about blowing up the weapon and more about convincing the Zindi that Earth is not a threat to them. Because
right.
that's what they spend most of their time doing in the Expanse. After a while, they spend a lot of their time in diplomacy with the Zindi species that are not assholes. You know, the arboreal species, the primate species, and the aquatic species. Because everyone knows...
the aquatics are kind of dicks, in my view, anyway.
Well, the aquatics are like...
They're very straight, rigid dicks, mind you, but they were still
dicks.
Oh
my goodness, you just said that.
I did say
that. They're basically ants.
I didn't realize what I said until after I said it.
The aquatics sort of struck me as ants, where, like, they basically takes... They're you know...
I'm on nobody's side, because nobody's on my side.
Like, they're basically, you know, it takes them forever to make a decision, and once they make a decision, it takes them forever to change their mind.
Right.
But we all know that insects and lizards are assholes, so those are the evil races, and the ugly ones, too.
I don't think insects were bad. I think they were a race of action.
Yeah,
no, I think so, because of the way they were handling things. Like, there was this problem in front of them, and the quickest path to victory that they saw was destroy humans, destroy Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And the lizards were like, yeah, let's do that. But the lizards had the motivation behind them of being the best and most powerful race, as opposed to just trying to get the survival of their species down.
Right, and like the, but then of course they tried to go a step further by having Hoshi taken prisoner on board the Zindi spaceship, the super weapon, and like having like them using her to unlock the remaining codes they needed to make it work. These are the bad guys, not the good guys. And like
yep.
they like Hoshi,
forcefully abductor.
Like one of the few times that Hoshi actually did anything cool was when that she like. Even though they've been, like, torturing her and brainwashing her, she actually adds another level of encryption instead of decrypting it for them. But then that kind
when
of...
When did she become a cryptologist?
I I don't know.
I thought she was like a linguist.
I'm willing to believe that she is a cryptologist too. I mean, whatever. Being a linguist means nothing in the future anyway, so whatever.
Well, it does in this series, because they don't have quite the Universal Translator down yet, right?
No, they do. We've actually talked about this before. The Universal Translator in Enterprise is a device that you point at someone until it works. And there's really no... There doesn't seem to be any sort of skill to using it. It's just like, I'm just going to
talk in the hole.
Yeah, I'm going to point it at you until it eventually works. But they did that, but then it didn't really pan out. Like, Hoshi being captured ended up being kind of an afterthought. It wasn't really that important in the grand scheme of things,
mm-hmm.
which is sort of sad. And then the other problem with the Zindi weapon is that if the Vulcans had actually gotten their shit together and protected Earth like they were supposed to, they could have blown it out of the sky. Like, it wasn't actually that threatening as a... Like, it had its laser, but it wasn't really impervious to harm. And, like, the only reason why it was so dangerous was because Earth was so badly defended. And the Vulcans, despite being the Vulcans' entire premise being that they were defending Earth, so they got to dictate what Earth was doing, you know, that was their whole shtick. They apparently just decided, nope, we're not actually going to help you. You don't actually deserve our help.
Did they actually straight up say that in the series?
No, but they weren't there when the super weapon like emerged over Earth, and like they had like advanced warning too. It wasn't like Enterprise wasn't completely cut off from Earth by that point,
right?
So like they kind of knew stuff was going down, and for some reason the Vulcans just refused to send any ships to help, which was just really weird. But that aside, it did as a weapon. I think that it did kind of work, and I think that the third season was an improvement over the first two, and I think because it actually had some focus...
Well, I think it illustrated that the stakes were so high, at least for, like, you know, Earth.
Right,
you know,
exactly.
Like, Archer and Enterprise, the stakes were really, really high, so that was good driving force for the characters.
Yeah.
You know, because, oh my gosh, big laser will destroy Earth, or at least a million people will die again at some point, you know?
Yeah.
At least the original motivation was to go find who had made the weapon, and that turned to, oh my gosh, they're making a bigger super weapon.
Yeah, and it was like, and so they established actual stakes that I would care about, which was the, excuse me, I think, okay, no, I thought I was going to sneeze for a minute there, but I'm good. But like that
stand
was,
stand down from yellow alert.
That was what they failed to do in Nemesis was establish any kind of stakes, whereas with the Zindi weapon, they did establish them, even if sometimes they did it kind of poorly, I think, because we're still talking about Enterprise, mm-hmm. and then unfortunately... when the super weapon also led into the time traveling Nazi vampires from space episode.
I just can never ever keep a straight face when we talk when those words come out.
But time traveling Nazi vampires from space.
Yes, it sounds like something out of our Mage game.
Well, I mean, it might very well be for all I know.
Well, for those that don't know, we had a Mage game that was going on. I think we may have mentioned a couple times.
Yeah, we've probably talked about it.
World of Darkness, White Wolf.
Yeah,
yeah,
and it recently came to an end. We were doing some pretty bizarre stuff.
Yeah, we were.
But like that sort of, you know, that was sort of the end of the super weapon, and it did actually, another thing it did have going for it was that there was a character death associated with it. Unfortunately, it was a character that was kind of a side character. It was the leader of the Makos, which for some reason they can't call them Marines. I don't really understand what's up with that. But you know, that guy died, and that guy had been kind of built up to be almost a main character. But his name was never... I don't think his name was ever in the main cast credits. So
no,
he was still expendable.
He was a guest star.
Yeah. So it was too bad that it was him and not someone, like, less expendable. But I, you know, I admired at least the effort that they were going to. And then we have... I want to talk about at least one more television super weapon before we get back to the movies. And talk about Dreadnought, which...
Now, I have not seen this episode.
You have not seen this episode?
No, because I've been going through Voyager recently.
Oh, dear.
And I actually saw... this episode on Netflix there. Okay. I haven't watched it myself yet. I'm getting to it. But I think more and more about it. I have not actually seen this episode.
Okay, well...
I know we've discussed it before.
I'll lay down the exposition for anyone else who hasn't watched it. Basically, the premise is that Voyager comes across this Cardassian ship that is flying around in the Delta Quadrant, and they're like, how did this Cardassian ship get here? And it's revealed that this was originally a missile that the Cardassians built, then sent it to blow up a Maquis base... It failed to go off.
Wait, they built a missile to send at a Maquis base.
Yes.
A missile.
Yeah, like space missile. So it's basically a spaceship that is supposed to blow up.
All right.
And it didn't go off, which was their, like, hand-waving exposition on how the Maquis got a hold of it. The Maquis reprogrammed it to send it back at the Cardassians.
Because the Maquis intercepted it, right?
Yeah, because it didn't go off.
Okay.
And then Chakotay, for some reason, decided, no, we're not going to do this. His reasoning was never terribly explained. And Taurus decided to do it anyway, and then she launched it, disappeared in the Badlands, and it got sucked over by the Caretaker, for some reason.
Caretaker now has Cardassian missile.
Yeah, and I guess for some reason the Caretaker didn't see anything wrong with just letting this missile loose. Just
wander the Delta Quadrant.
Which is kind of at odds with the way the Caretaker was established. But basically, it's established that the missile is also like the best battleship that any of us have ever seen. It's armed with like a million photon torpedoes and disruptors, and you know it's weird because it's like this incredibly powerful ship that's supposed to blow itself up, and like the Cardassians aren't really known for their super powerful warships, so it's like
they're using the same ship design now for, gosh, what, like 70 years?
Yeah, something like that.
As per like Nemesis, anyway.
Right. But like Dreadnought, just to give you an example, Dreadnought will wipe the floor with Voyager, like very easily. Like Voyager cannot touch Dreadnought. And then it's also established that somehow when Torres was working on it, she was able to give it adapting shields. You know, like Borg style. Like they can adapt. I don't know what. They never explained how she was able to do that or why she'd never do it again. But like
why does Voyager not have adaptive
shields? I don't know.
I mean how. Maquis, terrorist, Tariassian
ship. You're trying to make this make sense, and it doesn't.
It's true, we're talking about Voyager.
And then, like, the thing about this, and so, of course, it was this, and the Dreadnought had latched onto another planet that it thought was the Cardassian target that it had been sent after.
just thought it was a Cardassian target.
Yeah, it was, like, the same size, and its data banks were damaged, so it didn't realize it was in the Delta Quadrant.
Close enough, whatever.
Yeah, close enough. And so basically
this shit more and more.
It's this race against time to disable this missile before it can, you know, crash land into this planet and kill a bunch of innocent people.
Uh-huh.
But like the thing about it is that it's very like they try to establish a personal connection by having Taurus feel bad about launching this missile. But like why does she feel bad about launching this missile? Like never at any point In the entire series, other than this one episode, does Taurus ever demonstrate any kind of guilt or remorse for what she's done as a Maquis?
Mm-hmm.
All she did with this missile was send it to attack a Cardassian target, which is what the Maquis do.
Right.
Like, if that's the sort of thing that's going to get you down, you're not really doing a good job in the Maquis. and it never came up before this, and it never comes up afterwards. And
at what point in the series is this?
This is like, I think mid-season two, maybe season two. Three.
Well, they've been out of touch with being Maquis now for, what, a year and a half?
Right. The fact that this never came up before or after made it really hollow. Because it was like, no, she totally has this guilt problem. And it's like, well, why does she have a guilt problem? Just trust me, she does. She didn't have one yesterday. It's so cool. She won't have one tomorrow either. and so really what it is it's just like 45 minutes of Torres sweatily trying to fix this machine. And I say sweatily because at one point she's inside the missile trying to disarm it, and it like disables the life support systems, and like so it's getting all hot and shit, which is their which is their excuse to have her like sweat have her shirt get all wet and clingy, which is just, you know, what they love to do with Torres.
But Roxanne Dawson is, you know, kind of
yeah, cute. She is. I'm not hating on Roxanne Dawson. She does a fine job when they give her a decent script to work with.
Mm-hmm.
But this is just not one of them. And of course this is also an episode where Janeway decides she's going to blow up the ship rather than let the missile hit its target. We have another example of Janeway pie. But for anyone who doesn't get the reference, Janeway's self-destruct code is like Pi Alpha, like Janeway Pi Alpha 1 or something, but it starts with Pi.
It does.
So anytime Janeway threatens to blow up the ship, it's called Janeway Pi.
Janeway Pi.
And it's like, so, you know, the Dreadnought is racked with all kinds of really bizarre logical issues, like how the Cardassians were able to build this in the first place, why they used what, by all accounts, was a really...
Where were those during the Dominion War?
No, this was before the Dominion War.
Well, right, but where were those during the Dominion War?
Oh, yeah, where were they during the Dominion War? Where were they during the Klingon War, when the Klingons invaded Cardassia?
Yeah!
You know, why did they arm it with this outdated detonation system? I mean, you know, I get that they were maybe, they were trying to play on the whole, you know, a $50 million spaceship ruined by a 50-cent capacitor. but, like, it's, this isn't some, like, that sort of thing works because the 50-cent capacitor is some random part of the ship that right. no one pays too much attention to.
This you just is, assume it's going to work.
Yeah, this is the detonator on a bomb. Like,
very important.
There really is no more important part of the system than this detonator.
Right.
And so, and it's, and then of course, there's also, like, weird, like, continuity errors where apparently Dreadnought is armed with quantum torpedoes, even though those didn't exist yet, and are also a Federation weapon that the Cardassians don't have. So, bleh, I don't know what's up with that either.
Wait, the ship was armed with quantum torpedoes?
Yeah, Dreadnought is armed with quantum torpedoes.
Ooh.
Yeah, I know, right?
Ooh.
Right, right, okay.
well, they existed probably at that point. It's kind of like a prototype weapon, though.
Yeah, I guess.
In the Federation.
Right, but the, again, this is a Cardassian missile.
Right.
And it's just, it's sort of, and of course, then the even funnier part is that they have this, like, fake out where they think they've disabled Dreadnought, and it's, like, really early in the episode, so obviously they haven't.
Mm-hmm.
And they're talking about how they're gonna, like, take, they're gonna strip Dreadnought down and use it for parts.
Yeah.
Which, first of all, that seems really silly. It seems like they'd be better off just having it as a second ship, because it can clearly keep up with Voyager just fine. But they're talking about, like, integrating it into Voyager systems, and this isn't too long after their whole "we can't integrate with our own holodex" episode in Parallax, where they where they can't use the power systems from the holodex to power their replicators. But they're like, no, we can totally integrate totally foreign technology more easily
all
than
this
we can.
Cardassian stuff. We're shoving the ship; it'll be good.
More easily than we can with our own systems.
Mm-hmm.
But then, like, after all of this, get past all of this stuff, the real failing of Dreadnought is that there is no dramatic, like, effort by Torres. She just, eventually she figures out the solution. And, like, it's, you know, it's tense because they're, like, you know, she's running out of air and the ship's about to hit its target. But at no point, but she does not grow as a character in any way.
There's no catharsis for her, then.
No, there's no catharsis for Torres. And that's the, you know, that's where that's Dreadnought's biggest failing and why it doesn't really work as a super weapon. Because you need to have that sort of emotional or dramatic evolution of the character. Like, they have to hit some kind of really, they have to discover something important about themselves or move past something, or something has to happen, and nothing happens with Torres. She's exactly the same at the end of the episode as she was at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just sort of, it's sad. So that's about all I have to say about Dreadnought. Is there anything you wanna go into, Bob, before we move into the
next point?
Where
were these stupid things during the Dominion War?
Yeah, we should just rewrite.
I mean, the whole concept of just a on a more conventional, like, Star Trek level. Anyway, mm-hmm. nothing like deep. Like, oh my gosh, where's the character, you know, development for this? Just the idea of a missile moving at warp from point A to point B that is any, like, longer than, you know, like 40,000 kilometers or something like that seems just really dumb to me.
Mm-hmm.
Having that kind of setup. Now, there's only two instances I've seen missiles or long-range missiles in space kind of work. The first one was Wing Commander. Did you ever watch Wing Commander?
No, I never did.
I think it was released back in 97, I think. I didn't see it in the theater or anything like that. I watched it later. It's actually a really horrible movie, but it's based on the Wing Commander video game series.
Okay, so it's a movie then.
Right, exactly. All right. And there's a scene where the Kilrathi, who are the main bad guy villains, launch a missile at the Tiger Claw, which is, like, the main hero ship that we have in this movie.
Tiger Claw.
The Tiger Claw, yeah, they have a lot of awesome names, and they're, like, the Concordia. Oh, man, this ship is huge. And Admiral Tolwyn. Oh, man.
Tolwyn?
Yeah.
Is this
I will have you watch this movie, and you will love it.
I don't think that's true. Anyway, go on.
Eventually, the Kilrathi launch a missile called a Hopper.
Yeah.
Now, what a Hopper is, it's a missile that can cloak.
Uh-huh.
But its sensors go offline when it cloaks, so it has to decloak every so often, reacquire the target, and then point itself back at the target and move at it. That's what it does.
This kind of reminds me, this kind of just gives me this image of, like, a little kid with, like, a blanket over his head, and he's just, like, convinced that if you can't see him, he can't see you. And, like, you know, he's moving around, and every once in a while he gets out from under the blanket, and it's like, all right, where am I? Okay, over there. And he's, I don't know.
That's exactly how the Hopper works, exactly. I mean, you can't see it, obviously, because it's cloaked during those points, but the reason it has to decloak is because the heroes have to hop into their Rapier starfighters and shoot it down, and the only time they have, the only window they have is when it decloaks to reacquire.
Right.
So I thought that was a good way to do a cloaked missile that has to go over a long range. It cloaks, but it has to decloak in order to find a target.
Yeah.
The second one, which wasn't actually a real thing, was the
But this Hopper missile is real. Are you saying that the United States Army is currently working on?
You knew full well what I meant. Okay. You douche.
All right.
The second one was, and they weren't actually real, mind you. Was the what's the name of the episode? DS9 episode with Eddington and Sisko.
Blaze of Glory.
Where supposedly the Maquis sent out the message saying, yeah, these missiles are on their way to Cardassia. Mm-hmm. And Martok's like, yeah, we gave them cloaking devices. They're probably on the missiles.
Yeah, we thought...
So, cloaked missiles make sense to me because you can't find a cloaked missile, at least not reliably anyway. It doesn't come up on sensors.
Right.
Whereas giant Cardassian ship missile, you can kind of see that coming, right? Because it wasn't cloaked or anything, right?
Nope.
Yeah, so those are the only two instances I've seen of... you know, real and not real, as far as science fiction goes, in bad movies and good series, where it's worked.
Especially because, like, the whole problem the Cardassians were having with the Maquis wasn't that they couldn't beat them, it was that they couldn't find them.
Yep.
Like, we all know that the Cardassians, if they actually knew where the Maquis bases were, they would just, you know, show up. They would just show up and be like, and you know, they would just like roll up and blow them up, but they don't know where they are.
Sir, we found a Maquis base. Excellent. Deploy the missiles. But sir, we have like four ships in there. Nope, you heard me. Deploy the slow moving ship missile.
You heard what I said.
It's just a fantastic image to see that in the Central Command or something like that, or whatever order it is.
Yeah.
For the Cardassians, like, yeah, we found this base. Let's send a really slow missile at them instead of sending, like, these ships that are probably in the area.
Nope, not doing that. It's like, my goodness.
You know, it just seems so silly to me, just that idea of a missile, especially in just the whole Star Trek universe that isn't cloaked anyway.
Yeah, and I mean, that was the weirdest thing about Dreadnought, was that they decided, well, instead of it being invisible, it's going to be unstoppable. And it's like, again, this is you've built this enormous warship. Why don't you just use it as a warship?
Yeah, really.
Especially since the even more hilarious part about it is that if you think about it, every torpedo that Dreadnought fires is reducing its warhead payload. And, like...
that's also a good point.
And it's just like, oh, well, that's... And, you know, it kind of makes you wonder, it has a warp core. Why does it even have a separate warhead? Why not just have the warp core breach upon impact? Since apparently warp core breaches are, like, the biggest explosion in space.
It's true.
I kind of have to wonder if you could just make a warp core missile, just shoot a missile at a warp core at another ship.
Just drop warp cores on people.
I mean, I don't know. Warp cores apparently explode with a lot of force, in much the same way that in science fiction, ramming will always be way more deadly than shooting someone with a weapon. You know, just a thing that I've noticed.
Right.
But, all right, so I think that's about all we got for Dreadnought. And then we have the last and what is actually, in my opinion, probably the best Star Trek super weapon, and is just a really good super weapon in general, is the Genesis device from Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. And Wrath of Khan is obviously a great movie in general, and is arguably the best Star Trek movie. I personally like Star Trek VI better, but that's just a personal preference. I really love Wrath of Khan. And the Genesis device is... like, you know, as for anyone who doesn't already know, it was designed to turn a lifeless planet into a, like, you know, Garden of Eden-style thing by creating life. But if you deploy it where life already exists, it just, you know, destroys that life as part as...
start over.
Yeah, just wipes the slate clean.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, there you have this, its ability to be turned into a weapon. And the Genesis device actually takes a step away from the Death Star formula in that it's basically, it's a device that... is meant for good, but can be twisted to be used for evil, so
very easily.
And that's sort of the whole... that's, like, plays into the theme of the movie, because, like, if you recall, the reason why Khan is even still around is because Kirk decided to show mercy and do a good thing and let him live. But now that good act has come back to haunt him in the form of Khan. And that's sort of the same thing with Genesis. And it's also, like... and then it also plays into Kirk meeting his son for the first time, and, like, the whole, like, how, like, good intentions can so easily go wrong sort of thing.
Right.
And it's, so, you know, it just works out on so many levels. And then there's, you know, the scene where Spock has to go into the, you know, the flooded reactor core to fix the ship so we can get away from the Genesis device is something that will probably live forever in Star Trek, you know, in terms of Star Trek memory and just in science fiction memory in general. That's a cultural icon.
Yep.
And so it has...
ship out of danger.
Yeah, exactly. And then just from a more mechanical perspective, the Genesis device works really well because shields can't stop it. It's not a conventional weapon.
It can? They can't? No. Shields can't stop it?
Nope. Your shields...
In what way?
I mean, like, the Enterprise shields were still up when the Genesis device was going to go off.
Oh, okay. I thought they meant, like, shooting it, like, at the Enterprise or something like that. I'm like, no, I would sure it'd bounce off the shields or something. Or
no, but, like, when it goes off, if your shields are up, doesn't matter. So, like,
gotcha.
You know, from a tactical perspective, if you dropped that on a planet, even if the entire planet was protected by an energy shield, it wouldn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
And it has such an enormous range that you could drop it way outside of the planet's defenses, and it would still destroy the planet. And then it's, like, so, you know, just from a mechanical standpoint, it works really well. And then, like, Khan is really effective in his deployment of it, because he only uses it as a last resort, which is, again, you can kind of see what they're trying to do, how they were trying to ape that with Nemesis, where both villains deploy the superweapon when their ships are about to explode. The difference is being that, like, you know, is that Khan, the reason why his has this timer attached to it is because the Genesis device was never meant to be used as a weapon.
Right.
So it doesn't need to be deployed quickly. Whereas, you know, Shinzon's thing was always supposed to be a weapon.
Supposed to be a weapon, but takes forever to deploy.
Yeah, it just takes forever to use. And, like, you know, and then, of course, Khan is also, like, you know, spitting Shakespearean curses as he activates the weapon, whereas Shinzon, by that point, has already offed himself on a pike. and so, you know, we have this, and of course, it's hard to miss the parallels between Data sacrificing himself versus Spock. But, like, you know, with Data, it's like, you know, he fires a phaser at it, which is, like, sort of anticlimactic in the grand scheme of things. Whereas, you know, Spock has to go into, like, a, you know, radiation chamber and, like, wrestle the top off of this thing and put his hands down in it. And it's, like, this way more
big
dramatic.
Big glowing chamber thingamajig.
Yeah, it's way
more. Is
this
supposed to be the warp core of the ship? What is that thing exactly?
I don't know. It's some kind of thing.
Looks important.
It's important. Maybe it could be the warp core. I don't know. They hadn't started using the next generation sets yet, so we didn't have the big tube.
Right.
But I mean, that is, like, you know, that is sort of one of the very best examples of a super weapon and how it should be used, because it's all about the drama and the character development, and the actual, like, science is there too, and the actual technology is also very impressive. And we get to see some more of that in Star Trek III, even though Star Trek III isn't as well established. And isn't as well made, but you still get to see some of the ramifications of, like, a Klingon.
We did it, but only kind of.
Yeah, like. So anyway, again, I'm talking a whole lot. What do you think about the Genesis device?
Actually, I wanted to touch on the point of the parallels of Data and Spock. Actually,
go for it.
I really thought that actually did a good job of illustrating the finality of both those characters at the times they were made. Anyway, like that. Mm-hmm. Like, since then, we've seen actually both characters become resurrected.
Right.
Well, Data at least in a semi-canon sort of way, because of we have Countdown and then the novel, which I still haven't brought. I still need to bring that down for you. The Needs of the Many, which is the Star Trek Online novel.
One of these days, you will stop failing me as a friend.
It's true. This is a thing that may happen. But I thought that the scene where Data shot the Thermo reactor was not actually anticlimactic at all.
You didn't. You liked it.
I did like it. You know, I was like, I can't let, you know, my friend Captain Picard, who for the past, gosh, when did the series start? 2364, I think is what it was.
Something like that.
For the past 15 years has been, you know, helping me grow as a human, you know, making me more and more human. I can't let them die just because I am what I am now.
Right.
I thought it was a really awesome bit of just self-sacrifice by Data. Now, mind you, it felt really shoehorned in there because Data's like, nope, I'm going over to the Scimitar now, and runs down the corridor and has Data, or Geordi, drop the force field so he can go over there.
Yeah.
Right? When Picard is clearly going over there to destroy it already, as is anyway. Right? Like, that bit was kind of like, you know,
yeah.
That's kind of how I felt with that. But, I mean, the actual scene where he's there with, and slaps the emergency transporter on Picard, has him go, I felt pretty emotionally hit by that.
See,
that
I whole bit,
especially when Data whispers goodbye to him when he's already gone. Like, that felt like a very human thing. So I felt like Data had finally achieved his total character arc despite the way he got there.
Yeah, that's fair. I had a hard time getting over all the logical issues around it. Like, why didn't they just use the transporters on the shuttlecraft? Why don't they have more of those emergency transporters?
Well, that was a prototype, I thought.
Was it? I mean,
maybe. I don't remember all that well, but I know Data had, like, popped it out of his, like, wrist or something like that. I was like, yeah, I've got this thing now. I don't think we've ever seen it before.
No. But, you know, there are so many other ways.
Maybe we have. What were those? It was in the Best of Both Worlds. I just watched it last night with Jim, and they had, like, this like armband thing that had like a big bulky Game Boy looking thing on it.
They've had portable transporters before. Nothing ever that small. And then of course, there's the whole idea that why didn't they just send Worf over instead of Picard? Like the fact that Picard goes over and is in danger in the first place feels really, you know, shoehorned in.
Was personal for Picard.
Yes, they wanted it to be personal for Picard,
so that's why they did it that way. And, Picard is the ranking officer anyway. He's the captain, right? No one else on the ship. Well, maybe Riker's a captain, kind of, at this point, I think. I don't know if he's got the pips yet. But, I mean, it's Picard's ship, though, and what he says goes. If Picard wants to go over to the Scimitar and blow it up himself, Rambo style, he's going to do that because he's the captain.
Right, but I would think that Picard, being a relatively intelligent man, would know that was a bad idea. There's just this... I can see what you're saying. Like, the actual, like, scene... The actual part where he shoots the warp core is, like, okay.
The Phaleron generator.
Sorry, I keep thinking it's the warp core.
May as well be a warp core without that thing blew up.
Might as well. That part is actually okay, but it's just the way they arrived at it.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the way that they do it in Wrath of Khan is, like, this very natural progression.
Yes, absolutely.
And it doesn't, there's at no point where you stop and think, hey, what? Why aren't they doing things this way? This way would make so much more sense.
Uh-huh.
But, I mean, that's like...
Plus, Data's sacrifice was much more direct to solving the actual problem with the superweapon, because he directly dealt with the superweapon, whereas Spock was helping the ship escape from the superweapon that was about to blow up. Like, there was nothing they could do about it. There wasn't enough time to beam over and stop the bloody thing,
mm-hmm.
because it was gonna blow. There's just nothing they could do about it. So yeah, Spock's sacrifice was all about, let's get the hell out of here, I'm going to sacrifice myself so everyone can escape. Well, Data's was, I'm going to go over there and fix this problem that Picard's trying to fix myself, so that Picard can go live his happy life for the next 10 years, however long he's going to be alive, because he's human. Right, whereas Data can live forever, right?
And then,
well, theoretically, until his parts degrade.
And I think one of the best examples of why the... why the Genesis device works as well as it does is because it was never designed to be a weapon.
Right.
So, like, you know, there are these things, like, if it was designed to be a weapon, there are all these reasons, you know, that it might be an issue. Like, well, why does it take so long to deploy? Why does it, like, why isn't it mounted in some sort of launcher? Some, you know, things like that. But because it's not intended to be a weapon, you don't have to worry about those things. Whereas, like, you know, all the other super weapons that have set these large, obviously exploitable weaknesses, it's like, why would you build a weapon with that sort of weakness in it?
Right.
Which is ironic that this device that was supposed to, that was, you know, built to be like a life-giving device is actually, you know, one of the most effective super weapons we have.
Right.
Which I think is the whole point of Star Trek II, really.
Is it really a good parallel, then, to being an atomic superweapon, then? Like we were mentioning at the beginning of the episode?
I think it is.
I think it's something that was perverted into a weapon, or can be perverted into a weapon. I mean, an atomic bomb can't really be...
Well, no, but...
An atomic bomb is a weapon.
Right, right, but I think...
Atomic energy was perverted, because Einstein originally wanted... Or was talking about how atomic energy could, like, fuel things and, power things and whatnot.
Right.
But then get turned into a bomb from there.
That's actually exactly what I was about to get to, is that you're right, an atomic bomb is nothing but an atomic bomb. But that wasn't what Einstein wanted when he created the formula that makes atomic weapons possible.
Mm-hmm.
As you know, his work was never intended to be used as a weapon. It was supposed to be used, you know, to help people. And even though Genesis takes it a little more literally, where it's an actual device that is meant to help people, Einstein's work was theoretical.
Right.
I think it still works. Mm-hmm. Although, again, we have that sort of ironic thing of the villains are the ones deploying it, and it's like, cultural identity issues much?
Well, the villains got their hands on the Genesis device from the good guys, though.
Yeah, it's true.
The Genesis device. So if we backtrack for what we've been through now, can Dreadnought help anybody?
Not really.
I mean, it seems like it hurts everybody involved anyway. One, the Cardassians look really dumb.
Yeah.
And then the Maquis, you know, send it back as a weapon because it is a weapon to Cardassia, right? So that's out. Then we have, just before that, what was the one we talked about?
Zindi weapon?
The Zindi weapon. Another just weapon, right?
Yeah.
What good does that do anybody?
None.
All right. Then we have...
And we were talking about the Scimitar.
And the Scimitar. How does that help anybody?
Is
Thaleron energy good for anything but turning inorganic things into...
It helps modern artists who can't figure out how to get those statues posed just right.
What?
Well, I mean, it's sometimes hard to get a statue posed the right way, so instead you just get a guy, and you tell him, alright, just pose for a second, I'm gonna, like, take a picture of you or something, and then you flash him with some Thaleron radiation, and now he's a perfectly posed statue.
I need to write a fan fiction now of, the inception of Thaleron weapons, where it was originally, like, this civil engineer who was like, I have this great idea, guys. Alright, so let's take a person, right? We're going to pose them the way we need them to be posed, and we're going to zap them with Thaleron energy. Now, they have to sign a waiver to this effect, because they're going to be dead, but it'll be great.
It'll be great, don't worry.
But then Romulan's like, no, we can use this as a weapon.
Yeah, I can't imagine how that could have gone poorly. But
best civil engineer ever.
Yeah. So the end result of all this is that the Genesis device is really everything a super weapon should, like, wants to be, and, like, it's just, you know, it's still, I always get nostalgic when I talk about Star Trek 2 and the old Star Trek movies in general. And I really hope that we will see something similar in terms of its thought-provokingness in the new movie, which we talked about last week. If I keep saying it often enough, I'm sure it'll happen.
No new details have come out or anything like that, have they?
Not that I've seen.
Yeah, it's only been a week, though.
But don't worry, as soon as they come out, we will be all over that.
Uh-huh. Speaking of new Trek stuff, Seth MacFarlane wants to do Trek series.
Yeah, I heard about that. And my first reaction was, because I didn't want, like, my first reaction was thinking about all the Family Guy Star Trek references, but then I realized that's probably not what he meant.
Well, I mean, because I linked you the article, and he says he's kind of done with Family Guy to begin with, right?
Yeah.
He's kind of for a while, he wants to be done with it. I don't know if he wants to hand it off or just end the series so that, you know, his creative, you know, thing isn't taken away from him necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
But the article is actually dealing with how he wants to, you know, he doesn't know who would give him the keys, quote unquote, as it were, the article says, to the Star Trek mobile, but he would love to do a Star Trek series.
Yeah, and after some thought, I could totally see that working, because he is a huge sci-fi nerd, and he clearly likes Star Trek.
Oh, yeah.
And the most important thing, I think, that the article pointed out...
He's been on Enterprise.
Yeah. The most important thing that the article pointed out, I think, was that Star Trek used to be more topical than it's been recently, and Seth MacFarlane is nothing if not topical.
Heck yeah.
So yeah, I could totally see that. And so I think next week, what are we talking about?
I want to talk about the malleability of the universe in Star Trek.
Oh, you mean how, you know, the space-time continuum can be diverted with a snap of your fingers?
Exactly. That's right.
Okay. Well, I guess that'll be, we'll be some hitting up some Q and some Traveler.
We will be. It's true.
All right.
Others.
Well then, we will see you guys all next week.